Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
October 14th, 2011, the Norris Group returns with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An expert lineup of industry specialists join Bruce Norris to discuss current industry regulation, head-scratching legislation, and the opportunities emerging for savvy real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Brongeist, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Real Wealth Networks, Fry Wiles Webb and Brandy, MVT Productions, and White House Catering, who will provide the three-course meal for this black tie event. Visit iSurvived2011.com for more details.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Christopher Thornburg is a founding partner of Beacon Economics and widely considered to be one of California's leading economic forecasters. An expert in economic forecasting, regional development, real estate dynamics, and labor markets, he is one of the earliest and most adamant predictors of the housing market crash and of the economic recession that followed. In 2008, he was appointed as chief economist for California State Controller Don Chang, as well as chair of the Controller's Council of Economic Advisors. He also serves on the advisory board of Paulson & Company, Inc., one of Wall Street's most successful hedge funds. Dr. Thornburg holds a Ph.D. in business economics from the Anderson School at UCLA and a B.S. in business administration from the State University of New York at Buffalo. Dr. Thornburg, welcome back.
Always great to be here, Bruce.
Thank you for being part of our, the Nixon Library events the last 3 years. I really do appreciate your participation. Sorry you're not going to be there this year, though.
Yeah, unfortunately, my travel schedule, as you know, allow me to attend this year, but hopefully next year.
Okay, well, you've grown, I'm sure, in popularity. I read one of your reports on the website, and there was a quote, and we'll start with that. Beacon Economics expects growth in the second half of the year to be 3.5% to 4% range, short of some unlikely turn in events. So I guess I'm going to have to ask, have we had some of those unlikely events?
Well, we've toned down our forecast a bit. That was a little earlier in the year. We're looking at 3% growth, 2.5% to 3% growth now in the second half of the year. And no, we haven't had those unlikely events. Here's the key. I mean, we know the market's in turmoil. The bears are out in force. A lot of my colleagues in the forecasting profession are running around drawing odds, 30% chance of recession, 50% chance of a recession. It doesn't add up. First of all, you got to separate slow growth from a recession.
Okay.
There's a lot of reasons why the U.S. economy is not growing fast enough to put people back to work in a meaningful way. There's a lot of reasons why the U.S. economy continues to struggle in its recovery from the 2008 and 2009 recession. But that's a lot different than saying we are going to have another recession, another period of time where the U.S. economic output is contracting in a real sense, that we are producing less today than we were yesterday. For us to have another recession, there has to be a shock. There has to be a hit to the system that can cause the kind of turmoil that we call a recession. And if I look across the U.S. economy today, I don't see where that shock exists.
What if you look outside of the borders of our country and go to Greece?
Well, first of all, I would point out that Greece hasn't defaulted yet. Now, you may link a Greek default to potential for a U.S. recession, but that's not what people are doing. They're saying we're in a recession now, and the default hasn't even happened.
Right. The fact that their one-year T-bill is going for 130% interest kind of gives me an idea that they probably will, though.
I'm not sure it's 130% interest.
Yeah,
but
it actually
I know
is.
What you're saying.
It actually is.
There is clearly problems in Greece. And the question is, will Greece default? Because they don't need to. If they can continue to clean up their act, which is a big if, don't get me wrong, but if they can continue to make meaningful reforms, continue to get the support from the European Union, they can work their way back to some sort of what I would call orderly workout of their existing debt situation. I don't think they're ever going to pay all that debt back. But an orderly workout for some sort of debt reduction is a lot different than some sort of massive default.
So you're not worried necessarily about Greece also, you know, contaminating or causing other dominoes to fall in that area.
No, you know, people keep comparing Greece to Lehman. They said, you know, well, you know, Lehman had $250 billion in debt, and Greece has outstanding across the European Union, $400 billion. It's a Lehman-type episode. It's not a Lehman-type episode for a number of reasons. First of all, with Greece, we're talking about a straight debt default. With Lehman, there were counterparties in all sorts of transactions. There were they were intimately linked to other banks. There is a lot of... When it comes to Greece, we know what's coming down the road at us. Lehman was a total shock to the system. No one thought Lehman was going to be allowed to fail.
Okay.
So you have the surprise aspect, you have the counterparty aspect, you have the market maker aspect. Lehman and Greece are different situations. Now, if Greece did go down, would that hurt some banks in Europe? It would. But then again, does anybody truly think the French government is going to allow one of their major banks to be pulled down by Greece? Absolutely not. The lessons of Lehman are clear. You don't let your major banks default. Simple as that. The French government will step in with a TARP-type program. It will recapitalize its banks. The central banks, both here and in Europe, will work to provide the short-term funding necessary to calm investor jitters, and will get through it. Again, this idea, I mean, you have to have a lot of pieces in place for this thing to truly spiral out of control and start, quote-unquote, sinking the international banking system. And bear in mind, you know, let's say worse comes to worse, and a lot of these banks start getting hit hard. Whatever he's forgetting about, there's another way of dealing with this, which is just basic short-term regulatory changes.
Mm-hmm.
The reason these banks are in trouble, of course, is they have to maintain a certain capital ratio. If they start taking haircuts on these public debt, they're going to be in violation of those ratios, and they're either going to have to raise capital on the fly, or they're going to have to be closed down by the regulatory authorities. Well, there's a third way, and we saw that happen in the U.S. It's called the suspension of basic rules of asset valuation on bank balance sheets.
Okay.
You step in, you go, look, we're going to suspend these rules for 2 years. You better clean up. And that way the bank isn't undercapitalized, and they have the leeway to go ahead and do what they need to do. And in the meantime, of course, you've got to have that short-term lending from the various monetary authorities that will allow them to offset any kind of sort of runs that may occur on those banking systems. It can be handled. This can be worked through. And this idea that it's going to be allowed to spiral out of control and sink the worldwide financial system, I think, is a little far-fetched.
And I really appreciate and respect your opinion. You know that. When you were kind of talking negative about a housing market that was in the midst of a boom, that's a hard thing to do, and people thought you were a pessimist. And I know that you're really not built that way. And so you're not really trying to be an optimist now. You're being a realist.
No, I look at the data, and I know what the data is showing me. And I have some sense of the politics and what's going on in the regulatory authorities' minds.
Okay.
You know, there's, of course, the chance for a lot of boneheaded moves. I mean, Europe has shown us in the past that it can, in extreme moments of crisis, completely fail to do what needs to be done. Sure, there's that remote probability, but a remote probability is a lot different than people calling for a double dip.
Well, you know, I mean, we have this problem in our own country, and maybe it's extending over there. It seems that to do something that's painful in the short term, but most beneficial in the long term, rarely gets done.
Yeah, well, that's called politics.
Well, that's very frustrating.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I mean, we have all politicians, like most people on a two-year contract, have a short-timer syndrome. They're worried about getting re-upped, if you will, or re-elected. And so everything's about now. It's a problem. And what it means is that we kind of stumble from crisis to crisis. But, you know, right now, I just don't think that we're in a situation, again, that's going to send us into another hole.
Okay. What is this morning, took a look at the 10-year T-bill. It's 1.7-something percent.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me, A, that the Fed isn't really going to have much of an influence on this economy right now. Everybody is looking for the Fed to do something, and you can't lower long run rates much more. You certainly can't lower short run rates anymore. And frankly, cheap debt is not really the solution for what ails the economy. If you think about the U.S. and ask yourself, where's the problem? What's the issue here that we as a nation are dealing with? Well, about a third of our problems stem directly from construction. We're not constructing homes. We're not constructing commercial real estate. That's the tyranny of the inventory. For a number of years there, we built too much retail. We built too many homes. And as a result of that, those sectors are basically sitting in neutral until, of course, those inventories start getting worked down. The good news there is they are starting to get worked down. And I expect the construction will start picking up in 2012. And that will go some distance towards reducing some of the stresses on the U.S. economy.
In the major markets, let's say California being one of them,
yeah.
In the areas where you have land to build on, you have a price structure that would prevent it just because it's upside down.
Right, and it's funny you should bring that up because in California, we actually have the second lowest housing vacancy rate in the nation according to the 2010 census. We also have the second lowest housing affordability here. And it's funny because you go to Sacramento and what the regulators want to know is how they're going to push home prices up again in the state. You know, they want to worry, all the time they're worrying about how to make California more business friendly. Taxes, regulations, education, infrastructure, how do we make the state more business friendly? Well, why don't we start with home prices?
Well,
do you know what the most expensive housing market in Texas is?
I don't know.
Austin, Texas. The median price of a house in Austin, Texas is, you ready for this?
Okay.
$192,000.
Okay.
Maybe it's $194,000 right now. Think about that. The most expensive housing market in Texas is cheaper than the California housing market overall. It's on par with the Inland Empire housing market, which we consider to be an affordable housing market. When you think about businesses thinking about the location in California locating in Texas, you got to know that they're looking at Texas and going, well, gee, we don't have to pay people as much here. Did you know that Texas has more public employees than California does on the payrolls? They have a larger public sector than we do in terms of bodies. They get away with that because they pay their folks about a third less than what we pay ours, which, again, boils down to the cost of housing. You can do that when the median price of a house is $100,000 in the whole state. So we here in California need to stop thinking about home prices going up. For the long-run good of the state, I would say that we'd be benefited by seeing them go down more.
Well, except for your construction couldn't possibly come back. Unless
well,
you went
your
to
construction couldn't come back, not because the cost of bricks and labor is so high. It's because the cost of permitting these properties is so high. It goes back to the problem with building in the state. You know, you look at your some of these cities in California, and without anything else, just up front, you're going to pay anywhere between $40,000 and $70,000 to permit a single lot before you put a single piece of concrete in the ground. You're paying $50,000 to $70,000. That's ludicrous. That's not how you run a state.
Well,
you're much better off taxing people on an ongoing basis through property taxes than lumping all those costs up front on the builder who's making the property in the first place.
Okay. I was just really surprised to hear that you... Okay, California is the second most unaffordable state in the country, but yet it's got to be at the highest affordability it's ever been.
No, not the highest it's ever been. I mean, if you go back in the 80s, it was more affordable than today relative to incomes. But you're right, it's more affordable than it's been in the last 15, 20 years, for sure.
Okay.
So from that basis, yes. But again, you'd be surprised by how affordability really hasn't increased all that much, despite these drop in prices we've seen.
How could that be? It's a mathematical function of interest rates and price, and we got killed.
Yeah, but again, they in some places they haven't even fallen back to 2003 levels. As much as they came down, it's more because they have been driven to such unbelievable highs.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little hard sometimes when you live in Riverside, which is the epicenter of a lot of the damage, and you go, okay, there's a 380 house, and now it's 150. You know, not every place is like that. I'll give you that.
Yeah, and the Inland Empire is a little more extreme than most. But if you look in coastal areas, Orange County, San Mateo, coastal Los Angeles County, prices haven't come down much at all.
Well, it seems to me that one of the biggest impediments to California, and I'm not sure what the solution is there's a lot of people that owe more than a house is worth.
That's true across the United States. In fact, I wouldn't even worry about the so-called underwater folks. I would worry in general about the overall lack of equity. During the bubble, Americans picked up something on the order of $8 trillion in mortgage debt on the basis of what they thought was about $20 trillion in real estate wealth, maintaining about a 60% equity ratio in the housing market. Of course, the $20 trillion in housing wealth disappeared when the bubble broke, but that $8 trillion in debt more or less stayed in place. The net result of which, we as a nation are now carrying a record low level of equity in our housing market, about 45%. And yes, that's more acute in places like Arizona, California, and Nevada, where you had the bigger ups and downs in home prices. And this is probably the single largest impediment to a complete housing recovery. People talk about foreclosures. I disagree. That's not the issue. People talk about a lack of credit. It is harder to get credit now than it was in 2005, but that's because the markets were broken in 2005, not because they're broken today. For me, the biggest single problem is, in fact, the lack of equity. And the lack of equity is preventing move-up buyers from moving up the food chain, if you will, in the housing market. This is one of the biggest problems with the California housing construction market right now, because typically you build homes for move-up buyers. Well, that's not going to be the market to work in over the next few years. Quite the opposite. You want to be working in entry-level housing. But as you said, these fixed costs are such that really there's very little incentive to build entry-level housing. I mean, it's $50,000 whether you put a 4,000-square-foot house or a 1,000-square-foot house in that lot.
Yeah, that makes it very tough to build a small house. That really
You're
does.
Right, and that's a big problem for the state. Again, you got to go back to these fee structures and how the state pays for infrastructure. We got to get away from the builders and back to property taxes, and frankly, that means getting rid of Prop 13.
I was hoping you weren't going to suggest that.
Of course I'm going to suggest that. Prop 13 is one of the biggest fiscal disasters ever perpetuated on a state's budget.
What would you do with people that, let's say, that are, and that's going to be the biggest case, you know, where people are elderly, they have a house free and clear, and their taxes get raised to where...
You ever hear of reverse mortgages?
So just mortgage your house and pay your taxes.
You know, we all use the same roads, the same fire services, the same police services. I don't think that just because you happen to be 80, you shouldn't have to pay your fair share.
Okay.
I mean, as simple as that. And I don't think that a business, we want to be business friendly, giving businesses have been located here for 20 years, a massive cost advantage over a new business trying to start operations is reasonable. You have to level the playing field. People have to pay their fair share. When you think about California, people think California is a high-tax state. It's not a high-tax state by any stretch of the imagination. We're an average tax state. We feel like a high-tax state because we have given these just ridiculous protections to certain portions of the population and economy that we're not all entitled to. And those folks are completely undertaxed, and as a result of that, we have to overtax everybody else to make up the difference.
Hmm.
You know, Texas makes their senior citizens pay property taxes the way the rest of everybody else does. So does New York. So does every other state in the U.S., except for California.
What?
Yet somehow or other, we think it's terrible for seniors to have to pay their fair share here.
I wanted to just make one comment on the foreclosure, you know, the foreclosure not being a reason for California's problem. But one thing it does do, Christopher, is 70% of Riverside sales is either a short sale or an REO.
Not quite, but
it's pretty. It's close. Riverside, did I say California?
No, you said Riverside, but I think it's like 50% of Riverside. But anyway, but moving forward.
Okay. What that does is it doesn't replicate a buyer for the next transaction. Those people are not buying. So every time you have 1,000 houses moved, the charts that I've seen from CAR are something around 60, 65 to 70% of people aren't rebuying because they just lost their credit.
Well, that sounds good on paper, but if you go back to 2000 and you look at the housing market in Riverside, you'll see that close to 40% of single-family units, even in 2000, were actually rented out to other families. They were investor-owned, rented out. 40%. So it's pretty clear that there is a flourishing investor market out in the Inland Empire. People buy single-family homes, they rent them out to families that need them, and there's no reason in the world that that process cannot do the job of absorbing some of this excess supply out there, and I think it is. And
I
would even
agree.
Argue that you're involved in some of this yourself.
I would love to be involved in more if they would give us some financing.
I agree, and in fact, you know, in many ways, you know, right now, the administration, of course, has been talking about how do we get investors to move into the market to scoop up more of these units, and my answer is you don't have to do anything. You just have to get out of the way and, you know, let investors have the same rights as individual buyers when it comes to securing financing.
Yes, that would, I think, honestly, that would probably be the end of the problem in a very short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely, particularly in California because, again, there's not enough housing, second lowest vacancy rate in the nation. It's not going to fix the problems in Arizona or Florida or Nevada because the problem there is a vast excess supply, and it doesn't matter how many investors you pull into the market. There's just not enough households to absorb all that stock.
Are we, you know, what's interesting about, and we only have a minute and a half left, what's interesting about this downturn, as severe as it has been, we haven't lost a lot of migration out of California.
Well, that's because migration is driven by migration in and out of a state is driven by two things: relative unemployment and relative home prices. And as bad as things are here in California, they're bad pretty much everywhere. And unlike, say, in the mid-90s, where they were bad here, but the rest of the country was doing okay. And of course, at the same time, we had a lot of folks leaving in 2005, 2006 because of the skyrocketing cost of housing. This goes back to the idea that affordability is a good thing, not a bad thing, something we should strive for, not something we should fight against. But again, a lot of folks are simply leaving because they couldn't buy a house. Well, again, with affordability being so much better in California, and yes, California is still providing one of the best standard of livings in the nation, not to mention some of the most incredible vistas, some of the best beaches, some of the best food, and some of the best wine. There's a lot of reason to be in the state, and I think you see that. You know, people want to be here.
Yeah, they'll come back. They have before. We are out of time. Thank you very much, Christopher Thornburg, for being with us. I would go to use his website, Beacon Economics. Can you give me that website?
It's beaconecon.com.
Okay.
It's beaconecon.com.
Okay. Dr. Thornburg, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be here.
All right.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2011. Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Conaway & Conaway, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan and Clark Partners LLC, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Pacific Sunrise Mortgage, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Raven Paul and Company, Tri-Emerald Financial Group, Tony Alvarez, and Weston South Coast Plaza. Visit iSurvived2011.com for more details.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.